This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, I'm here with Philip Leffer. You're the winemaker at Jacob's Creek, or part of the winemaking
team? I'm part of the winemaking team at Jacob's Creek.
Yeah, you've been there for, what, 45 years, I hear?
No. I've been making wine for 45 years. I've been looking after winemaking at Jacob's Creek for about 16.
16 years. Excellent. You've just done a presentation at Wines of Australia talking predominantly about alcohol levels in wine. It's a very hot topic in the industry at the moment.
Yeah.
Some of the things you touched on were you talked about making the vines better, but not necessarily the grapes better. And there became a disconnection between phenolic ripeness or flavour ripeness versus sugar ripeness. What's driving that disconnection?
Well, the point that I was making is that there's been a tremendous investment in viticultural research over the last 30 or 40 years, which has led to us worldwide having much better vines, and that's been a consequence of understanding the nutrition of the vine, its water needs and what have you. So we've produced these marvellous plants. In the process, we've produced vines with much larger canopies, which, by the way, probably need more water to support them, so they're a bit of a drain on the environment. And there seems to become a disconnect between the development of sugar and the development of flavour. So by the time that the fruit is flavour ripe, the sugar development is higher than it traditionally was. So we end up making wines that then have a higher alcohol.
Is it because the vines aren't diseased anymore, or what?
Well, that's no doubt part of it. There's a lot less viral problems than there used to be. Certainly things like powdery mildew. There's no reason why any vine in the world nowadays should have powdery mildew, because we know how to manage it. Downy mildew is not a thing of the past, but it's still easily controlled. So all of these things have led to taking stress off the vine, and stress off the vine means a bigger canopy. So it might not be, you know, some people say, oh, well, we're not stressing our vines enough, but that might be a symptom. You know, the canopy itself may really be the answer. These big canopies are quite demanding. They have a shading effect. There's a whole lot of things that might be affecting it. But quite clearly, that is the big thing that's different in viticulture today than going back 20, 30 years when we didn't have this problem of high alcohol.
The canopy itself generates the sugars themselves,
yep.
But the flavours, they come... They're
well, they come from the same source, but maybe... That maybe sunlight has got a lot more to do with flavour development. There's a whole lot of things that aren't quite entirely understood, but certainly sunlight's got a big part to do with it.
Okay, and you think maybe if the grapes are being sheltered a bit too much, they're not getting that sunlight? So.
Could be, but you know, the answer is not to expose the fruit. If we expose fruit in Australia, we get sunburned fruit, and that's even worse. But you know, there's some logic in thinking, well, what have we done that's different? And what we've done different is produce, or done differently, is these great big, very healthy vines with big canopies.
So it seems a shame that you're going to have to go back to problems.
Well, no, I mean, we don't suddenly have to go right back to where we were, but maybe we need to be experimenting to see what happens if we use less nitrogen on the vine, which will probably have an impact on the size of canopy in due course. Maybe instead of watering or adding water the day before we think the vine's going to get into stress, we don't add the water until the vine is slightly in stress. Not too far, because you don't want to kill off the leaves or stop the leaves photosynthesizing, but perhaps we've just been too generous in giving that plant everything it wants.
Okay. Nitrogen obviously is a problem because it costs a lot of energy to produce nitrogen, then you're putting it on the plants as well. So is it something that's quite regularly done, is adding nitrogen and...
People do a petiole analysis of grapevines to determine its absolute nitrogen needs. A lot of nitrogen can come naturally through cover crops that fix nitrogen in the soil. So it's not necessarily a cost issue of putting on artificial nitrogen via urea or whatever. It might be the way you're actually... or the selection of cover crop.
Oh, okay.
So it's not just... adding chemical nitrogen, it might be nitrogen that's been fixed by sub-clover, for argument's sake.
Another interesting thing that you raised in your presentation was the night harvesting. Mm. You talked about that a lot of grapes now become ripe at the same time. People tend to harvest at night for white wines, usually I thought that was to do with keeping the acidity levels up. They seem to be higher at night.
Well, no, it's primarily to bring the fruit in when it's cold, because once if you start to harvest hot fruit, then the chemical reactions take place quickly, and you tend to extract tannins and characters out of the skin that you don't want in white wine.
Mm-hmm.
That's primarily what's behind cold picking of white grapes. And it ends up being nighttime picking because it's obviously the coldest time of the day. The point I was making was that it's also the time when the fruit, the berries, have the greatest amount of moisture in them, so that the fruit is turgid. In the daytime, when the vine's transpiring, there is some loss of moisture out of the grape, so there's a concentrating effect. If you pick at night, when all of the liquid is back in the grape, then the percentage of sugar is fractionally lower. And that might be low enough to affect, a 0.5% reduction in alcohol in the wine. It's also possible that on a, depending on the relative humidity, that you've got some dew on the fruit.
Why don't you just tip some water in to drop the alcohol level? Because that seems to be the same thing.
Exactly. United States are allowed to do it. It's the only place in the world you're allowed to do it. In Australia, if you do that, you go to jail. We are not allowed to add water for any purpose other than the incorporation of something you've got to add in the winemaking process. The American legislation is quite sensible in that aspect, that it more or less says that if the fruit has got overripe and has desiccated, you're allowed to replace the lost water. We can't do it.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And I'm not sure whether Americans can do it for wines they want to export outside of the United States, because it could be that doesn't comply with the winemaking requirements of the importing country. I don't know the answer to that, but certainly they have the freedom to make sensible adjustments. And pardon me, going back 50 or 60 years in Australian winemaking, that's the way it was done, because it was not seen, if the fruit got too ripe, people would dilute it back with water, and it was not seen as doing anything illegal because it made better wine, and the argument was you're replacing the water that you lost through desiccation, because people still wanted to make extremely good wine. But if it got up to 15 Beaumé, you would dilute it back perhaps to 13.5% and make a vastly better wine. And it wasn't, there was no sense of doing the wrong thing. But as time's gone by, of course, there's legislation to prevent the people who would abuse the system from doing it, and in the process it's cut out everybody from doing it.
The other thing I quite liked, you touched on yeast selection. In the past, brewers and winemakers have been looking for the most efficient yeast, convert the sugar to alcohol. You said you talked about maybe finding inefficient yeasts now.
We're yeasts that are less effective at converting sugar into alcohol.
So that'll effectively mean you still eat up the sugar, but you'll get less alcohol from it.
You get less alcohol, but you're producing something else, and the something else you produce has to be something that's attractive in wine.
Oh, true. So it's not a zero.
It's not. If you're not producing alcohol, what are you producing?
Yep.
Now, generally speaking, the alternative thing is that yeast will produce glycerol.
Well, that's not too bad, that's a
nice textural thing, so there's no problem whatsoever.
Yeah. So you might find that over time, if these yeasts are used, the wines will just get a slightly heavier feel in the mouth.
Well, I think really that the amount we're talking about probably would be hard for anybody to detect.
Okay.
But, if it produced something that was unattractive, then it wouldn't be a good choice.
Yeah.
Now, at the moment, there's a small difference between various yeasts, but it's possible that with breeding and selection, we could, over time, come up with yeasts that were, in fact, capable of making a significant difference, 1% or 2%.
So what would that do to the wine? You'd land up with wines, you could maybe have quite long hang times, get your phenolic ripeness, your flavour ripeness right up, and then still produce reasonably
still low produce wines at sort of comfortable levels of alcohol.
You'd still end up with quite ripe flavours, though, because...
Well, there's nothing wrong with ripe flavours. What's wrong is overripe flavours.
Yeah, those you get wines that become just too jammy, too opulent almost.
Exactly, yeah.
I quite like wines that are quite lean, but that's... That's quite a separate type of issue, though, isn't it?
At least it would stop the winemaker being forced to pick fruit that wasn't ripe. I'm not suggesting that people should pick things overripe, far from it. But pick it at optimum ripeness, but at the moment, that optimum ripeness, in terms of flavour, can still lead to 14, 14.5% alcohol.
Mm. The other thing you touched on was aerating the wine. Obviously, you pick a wee bit earlier, you get slightly more greener flavours in the wine. Yeah. Bit of micro-oxidisation. Is it micro-oxidisation?
No. It's more... This is during fermentation. So yeah. You're talking about bleeding in quite a bit of oxygen or air during the fermentation process.
But it's a similar...
Micro-ox is something you tend to do post-fermentation. Mm-hmm. And you're putting in minuscule amounts of air. This is putting a fair bit of air in during the fermentation process.
Would that mean your sulfur levels in the wine would have to be a bit higher? Or?
No, because during fermentation you don't have any sulfur.
That's right.
And the wine is...
It's reductive, isn't it?
Yeah, the wine's reasonably protected in any event, so it's not as if you're going to turn around and produce oxidised wines.
Yeah,
but there's a balance. You wouldn't be blasting air through it, but putting enough in there to accelerate some of these reactions with the harder and greener and tougher tannins.
If your sugar levels are getting ahead, you pick a wee bit earlier, your flavour levels may not be there.
Well, it depends whether you are waiting to get ripe tannins or whether you're waiting to get ripe flavours.
True.
Now, winemakers are doing both things. I think, well, the fruit tastes right, but I've still got these immature green tannins.
Yep.
I'll end up with a wine that's got hard, unattractive mouthfeel. So they're waiting for the green tannin to disappear. That's one thing you may not have to worry about with a bit more air during fermentation.
Sure. And I suppose also as a grape ripens, it goes through various flavour profiles through the ripening, and it might be that the flavour you want early on is actually the flavour you...
Oh, absolutely.
But you can't get to it because...
You can't get to it because you're concerned about the sort of green, immature tannins.
So in theory, you could start coming up with slightly different or even new styles of wine by this process.
Yeah. Well, people are doing it, but it's only part of the solution.
Yeah.
It's not going to, something that's really green is still going to be really green.
Mm. Would people start considering harvesting to get these flavours and maybe use it as a blending component to add complexity to the wine?
All those sorts of things are possible. I think all those sorts of things are probably starting to happen.
Okay. These are sort of things that you said were fairly short-termist, you could do immediately or within the next wee while to achieve it. You reiterated one about your yeast selection. I presume that's more about breeding new yeast.
Exactly. Right at the moment, there's a choice of 50 yeasts and some are more efficient than others. But if people started to actually set out, microbiologists to actually look at what they could do to breed more inefficient yeasts, as it were, that'll be long term, but they could build in or discover yeast with a much bigger differential than we have at the moment. Right. So it's not going to happen overnight.
This whole debate about alcohol being too high, etc. I know it's in the UK, particularly in the trade for the last couple of years, and it is drifting into the consumer now, particularly with government trying to talk about alcohol awareness, which is an important issue in the UK. Is it so much of an issue in Australia or any?
I think it is pretty much all the way around the world. There's concern about abuse of alcohol, harm from irresponsible consumption of alcohol. In the context of all the issues that the alcoholic beverage industry has, I think slightly higher alcohols in table wine is really right at the bottom of it.
Yeah.
But that's no reason why we shouldn't be addressing that as well.
Sure.
Yeah, I'm quite sure that 14% alcohol table wine isn't contributing to binge drinking and all the other sorts of problems that exist. But it could be contributing to people drinking more alcohol than they need to have an enjoyable glass of wine.
Yeah, sure.
And also, so it's part of sort of social responsibility of the wine industry.
Is it something that obviously you're aware of and because you're willing to talk about it? Jacob's Creeks, are you trying to move to slightly lower alcohol?
Categorically. We've set ourselves goals. Some might be unreasonable goals, but if you don't set yourself a target, you won't get any. And we've set ourselves a goal to see if within 2 years we can produce wines of exactly the same amount of peel as we have now, but not exceeding 14% alcohol.
And across your entire range, or
yep.
So you want it.
There might be an odd exception, but it would mean bringing everything down by something like 0.5 to 1% alcohol.
Okay, so that's a goal. Any other goals that you've set yourself
in terms of alcohol management? No, I think that's an achievable and a sensible goal. We could say bring it down by 2%, and in the process lose the appeal of Jacob's Creek.
Sure.
Because people are buying Jacob's Creek not because of its alcohol content, they're buying it because it's an enjoyable glass of wine. So first and foremost, we have to retain the appeal of Jacob's Creek. So the skill that we have is that we don't lose any of the appeal, the flavour, or anything else, but reduce the alcohol.
Excellent. Okay, that sounds very, very good. Just on something completely different, just before we wrap up, Jacob's Creek Sparkling Wines.
Yeah.
Relatively new to me, anyway.
Yep.
Doing really, really well. You know, lots of really good news.
Extraordinarily well. I mean, we've made the release of Jacob's Creek Sparkling Chardonnay Pinot Noir in Australia in 1998. So it's not yet 8 years old. And the pink one far more recently.
1998? 10 years old.
Yeah, what did I say?
Eight.
Eight, sorry. 10 years. ten years old. So that's not quite 10 years old. But it started in a small way. So it's now become a very substantial brand in Australia, United Kingdom, quite a few places around the world. And I think, you know, there's a lot of reasons for its success, not the least that it carries the name Jacob's Creek, because it was one of the first situations where a table wine brand had added a sparkling wine to it, because most sparkling wines historically had tended to be standalone products. So I'm sure that helped it being part of a successful brand. But we also set out to make a different kind of sparkling wine than what was generally available, recognising that people drink sparkling wine nowadays a lot more as a social drink, as an aperitif. So they want something that's light and bright and clean and refreshing, not something that's big and full and yeasty and traditional. Not that there's anything wrong with those wines, but it's horses for courses. So we made a wine that was a blend of Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. The focus was on Chardonnay fruit flavours rather than yeast, because clearly the world liked Australian Chardonnay, so we might as well be coming on that. So lots of strong Chardonnay flavours. The Pinot Noir was put in there at about 25 to 30% as a foil to what could otherwise be quite overtly rich and tropical Chardonnay flavours.
So to give the leanness to it? Or?
Well, what it does is it's a flavour cut-off. So you have a glass of, if you smell Jacob's Creek Sparkling Chardonnay Pinot Noir, it smells like Chardonnay. It's got peaches and melon and sort of tropical flavours. When you swallow it, you get that sensation in your mouth, but within 4 to 5 seconds, it's all gone. Pardon me. And all that's left is a sense of cleanliness and refreshment in your mouth, because the Pinot Noir has just chopped off that rich tropical flavour. Now that's, to me, is what aperitif wines are all about. Lots of flavour when you're drinking them, but the moment you swallowed them, nothing, just a clean sensation. And it was a style of, I mean, people have always spoken about aperitif sparkling wines or aperitif champagnes, but nothing was quite like that. So I think that caught the fascination of people, of drinkers. We also attempted to get some of the dryness by leaving a bit of tannin in the wine, which allowed us to have a lower acid. And drinking some sparkling wines on an empty tummy, you know, two glasses and you start to feel decidedly uncomfortable.
Yeah, yeah.
So some of the dryness comes from tannin and doesn't rely entirely on acid.
Is that a bit strange? Because it's traditional method. And
it's traditional method, but then it's transfer. So it's bottle fermented.
Yep.
But transfer process.
Oh,
rather than individual bottles.
Because normally bubbles form on crystals, and if you've got tannins in the wine, then you get all sorts of problems with bubbles during disgorgement.
Yeah, but I mean, sparkling wines have tannin. I mean, champagne traditionally, you actually make a tannin addition to it. So we just let more of some of the tannin from the Pinot Noir come through to just give it a little bit of firmness, which meant we could then run with a slightly lower acid.
Okay.
To make it an easier drink on a tummy.
Excellent. Well, thanks very much for your time, Philip. I appreciate it.
Not at all.
Cheers.
Thank you.